tonight we'll be looking as the final piece of subject matter that he had to confront and was controversial concerning, namely the state of Israel. You see, Israel, the founding of that state, which happened, of course, when he was Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University. He had come there in 1941. 1948, the state was founded. And there's a book that, of the five addresses, it's called, put out by the Mizrahi, the Religious Zionists of America, that have kind of become somewhat well-known in religious Zionist areas as Rabbi Soloveitchik's manifesto about the importance of the state of Israel. Before beginning, let me just point out, and I'm sure some of you are aware of this, and this won't be as new to you, that the whole notion of creation of the state of Israel still is, and was, of course, in its founding, a controversial matter in religious circles. Anyone want to suggest why that would be the case? You think everyone would, you know, celebrate? Why would some wonder about that phenomenon?
Yeah.
Political act, not a messianic act necessarily.
Yeah.
Killer state. Anything else? What would you think if I said to you the Messiah needs to come? What would we have to do for him to come? What would you think? Just have to make a state? What would we have to do if we want redemption for the Jewish people? What do you think we'd have to do? We'd have to repent, right? Does it seem like the Zionist movement necessarily was an act of repentance? In fact, in a sense, was just the opposite. For many, you know, it was considered to be an attack upon traditional Jewish values and upon the Torah scholar, and the vision should be that the new Jew should be someone else, a different kind of person, and be an active person, not a passive person. So it could be seen as an attack upon traditional Jewish values. So it so happens that this was the backdrop to which the state was created. Rabbi Soloveitchik here was not alone. There were those who favored the state in religious camps. There were those who were against it, and it again goes on today. But Rabbi Soloveitchik felt himself, before we do the reading here, in his theological statements, he says that he felt the founding of the state was unique for six reasons. I'll just tell you what they are. Number one, he thought it was a political wonder in the sense that he said this is the first time that East and West, that is to say that Russia and America, the Soviet Union and America, both agreed on something. In the United Nations vote, they both agreed to go ahead and have the state of Israel. All these things he called knocks on the door, kol do di do fake. He said, this is the voice of my beloved, it says in the Song of Songs, knocking on the door. He said, after the Holocaust, it seemed like God had left us. But then came these knocks on the door through the founding of the state of Israel. That was one, the political wonder of it all. Number two, he said the military victory, of course, which we all recognize, seemingly was an incredible miracle, this little state against every Arab country surrounding it on all sides. The theological statement, he said, this is number three, the notion that Catholicism had always preached that the Jews would wander and they would never find rest for their rejection of the Christian Savior, and along comes the state of Israel, and the Jews return to this land. This was not supposed to happen, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, according to classical Catholicism. Number four, he says, the resurrection of the Jewish consciousness, which was amongst many people, but especially among the youth, he said, of the time. Something, again, miraculous, he said, which other events could not have stirred. Number five, he said, the message given to the world that Jewish blood is not for the taking, that we have an army, that you just can't go ahead anymore and just throw Jews into the gas chambers and just depend on the United States to do something or some other country to do something. From now on, Jews are going to take action if their lives are in danger. And this kind of goes with his whole notion of dignity and technology and man being able to have control over these things, which he welcomed. And finally, he said that Jews have, of course, you know, a place to go for refuge. If they are ever attacked individually or as a nation, they have a place to go. Why did he see it differently than others? Let's read this reading now that we have Joseph and his brothers, which is a personal perspective upon the founding of the State of Israel, and which in a sense sums up kind of, I think, Rabbi Soloveitchik in all the areas that we've seen. Okay, Mizrahi was founded in 5662. That's the, Mizrahi means east, right? It represents the religious Zionists of America and of Israel. The founders of our movement fulfilled, go out from your country, from your birthplace, and from your father's house. For he who joined the Mizrahi was virtually excluded from his birthplace and ostracized from his spiritual paternal home. We were lonely. Of course we were. We were lonely, as Joseph the dreamer was lonely among his brothers who mocked him. Our brethren also suspected us of many sins and looked at us from far off. He's talking about, let's say, more classical Orthodox Jews or Yeshivish Orthodox Jews. Rabbi Soloveitchik was in the other camp, by the way. I think I mentioned to you he did not get the job as the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv because they said he was too much against the state of Israel. This is before the state was founded. It's a letter against him, saying he's in the yeshivisha camp, he's in the Aguda camp, he doesn't believe that you should find the state, and everything. Himself used to be on the other side that he's now left. They related us to us as Joseph's brothers had dealt with him, and they saw him from far off before he approached them. We must be clear about this. It was not a pleasant experience to be far from the tribes of God, from the great ones of the generation. He's talking about the great Torah scholars in Europe, which included his grandfather. From Levi, authoritative teachers in Israel. They will teach your statutes to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. From Judah, leaders of the generation who are the true providers, who concern themselves with communal needs and whose words were like those of the prophetic Urim of the high priest in all political and social questions. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his legs until Shiloh shall come. And from Benjamin, saintly ones of the generation who lived within the four cubits of the law in holiness and purity, and to whom Jews journeyed to receive their blessings. The beloved of the Eternal shall dwell in safety by him. He shall harbor him by all day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. Joseph himself possessed greatness in Torah learning, leadership, and saintliness, and the yawning gap which had grown between him and his brothers caused him much sorrow. To be separated from his outstanding brothers, ostracized, as it were, not only by a part of the Sanhedrin, but by the majority of them, was a tragedy for Joseph. So this is our personal plight here. That most of religious Jewish leaders at the time, the head of Yeshiva, Chafetz Chaim, this is still before the founding of the state, but their view kind of was still, if it's anything, it's got to be a religious state, can't be a secular state, has to be found under a notion of people repenting. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik said they were in the minority, the religious Zionist camp. They, the contemporary anti-Zionist religious brethren, drove Joseph, religious Zionist, from the Stieblach, small centers of prayer and study in Eastern Europe, forced him out of the rabbinate, I didn't know about this, and expelled him from the Society of Torah Scholars. They humiliated him everywhere. The tragedy above all lay in the fact that the controversy between the Joseph of 5662 and his brothers, I guess this has come out to 1948 or something like that, the tribes of God was in truth based on a misunderstanding, just as the ancient controversy between Joseph, the son of Jacob, and his brothers was a result of they saw him from far off, a lack of communication. What in truth had disturbed Joseph's peace of mind, what had disturbed it? In regard to such matters, our sages have said, a man's dreams beseech his innermost thoughts and feelings. What did Joseph seek? To what did he aspire? What foreboding troubled him? The answer is an obscure feeling of insecurity frightened him. What were the elements of insecurity? The biblical Joseph was not persuaded that, and Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's wanderings, would endure for long. The words, for your seed shall be in a stranger in an alien land, kept rolling in his ears. He saw himself and his brothers in an alien environment far from the land of Canaan, in new circumstances and under new conditions of life. In his dream he saw, behold, we are binding sheaves. We are no longer in Canaan. We are in the land of Egypt that can no longer be shepherds. We are integrating into a new economy with new styles of living characteristics and laws. We can no longer support ourselves by pasturing sheep. This is, again, what's known as a drasha. He's taking this little story of Joseph, and we're into economics, we're into, you know, from sheep and everything else. For him, it's an easy transition. The sons of Jacob have to learn new applications such as farming, building, stone cutting, woodwork, and become skilled in gold, silver, and brass, which are adapted to the new conditions. Basically, he dreamt of a new framework within which the unity of the family could be preserved, even in the far places where the creator of the universe would scatter them. His constant preoccupation was a continuation of Abraham's tradition amidst a new economic structure and civilization. Now, the only thing about this drasha is, interestingly, that's talking about Joseph and his brothers and Israel going to Egypt, where our case here is the vision of leaving the other nations and going to Israel. It's just the opposite, but okay. He says that it was the same dream and vision. The brothers did not understand him, for they looked upon the future as a continuation of the present. The biblical Joseph relates, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bow down to me. There is secular culture, great and powerful technology, creating wonders and changing the foundations of our life. Even if it's true that in Canaan we can get along without it, the secular culture entails destructive elements, many negative and perverse aspects. It may be a blessing and a curse simultaneously, and thus, as long as one can live without it, so much the better for the spirit. Finally, we'll have to relate to it. The confrontation will not take place in Canaan, however, where life flows serenely, but in a new alien land where the temple of life is greatly accelerated, Egypt, and fundamental changes occur daily. God's decree, your seed will be strangers in a land not their own, will be fulfilled sooner or later in a land not their own. I fear we will not be able to maintain a separation between us and the surroundings. If we will not be prepared for new conditions, the environment will swallow us up, will swallow us. Our intellectual forces will completely assimilate. On the other hand, if we think of the future, we can plan for binding the sheaves, for the sun and the moon and the 11 stars, for a new economic and social order. We can render Abraham's heritage triumphant in the alien surroundings too. Abraham's power is very powerful, but only when we are prepared for the conflict and know exactly what to do in the new environment. this is Rabbi Soloveitchik in general here. You know, his view of secular studies in general, it seems to me. And his whole life's work was to make sure, with reference to secular studies, women's learning, whatever it be, that we apply, the need for the age, existentialism as philosophy, to go ahead and deal with modernity. Others felt there's no need for that. The same power that was always there will be here as well and will protect us like it always has. But if Soloveitchik felt, and this is why he really was a modern, again, figure, that, there needed to be, even within orthodoxy, as it were, an updating and a reapplication, in order to adjust to the new situations. And he's not talking of philosophical viewpoints and approaches. He's advocating here, a different approach, as again he has, we've said, throughout. Joseph quarreled with his brothers. Certainly. Was there dispute for the sake of heaven? Most certainly. Joseph perceived the fate of his sons, the sons of Jacob, from the perspective of a bleak future, lacking in security and mysterious. When would be fulfilled the decree of your seed shall be a stranger? And he demanded preparedness to meet that future. The brothers, however, were unanimous in their opinion that it is forbidden to gaze too intently into the mirror of the future. Do not probe that which is wondrous for you. That one must judge the future by the present. That one must judge the future by the present. We live in Canaan. It is not necessary and forbidden for us to make preparations for a land that is unknown to us, and a future that is hidden. In this dispute, in the name of heaven, divine providence decided in favor of Joseph in the Torah. And the house of Jacob was saved from destruction only due to Joseph's dreams. What would the brothers have done without him when the famine was intense in the land and they finished the food, right? They had to go to Joseph in Egypt. Were it not for Joseph's dreams, the entire house of Jacob would have perished of starvation. But for God sent me before you to give you survivors in the land, the heritage of Abraham would have perished, and the choosing of Israel would not have been realized. What was the dispute between the Joseph of 5662 and his brethren, the great Torah leaders? These, our brothers, great leaders, rabbinical giants of Israel, men of holiness and piety, evaluated the future from the standpoint of a peaceful and tranquil and satisfied present. When the communities of Brisk, Mohilev, Kashilev, and Lubavitch were still intact, an era when hundreds and thousands of synagogues were filled with worshippers and Torah students. Although the fire of revolution had been already seized part of the encampment and some of the youth had rebelled against our traditional way of life, those of true faith comprised the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people, and of the Jew on the street and the Jew in the house of study could justifiably have been said how good and beautiful these and brothers dwell together. Therefore, they believed that joining together with Western European Jews, who were generally non-observant and not overly pious, would be dangerous for Judaism. Our brother cited the verse, when you joined the wicked, God destroyed your acts. And they categorically rejected all dealings with the secular. Their entire pattern of thought, motivation, and feeling was permeated with sanctity. The environment within which they lived was laden with holiness, tradition, and Torah. It's interesting how he defends the other view, even as he, of course, is going to state his own. Joseph of 5662 unconsciously sensed that it was forbidden to rely on continuation of the status quo, that great changes were about to occur in Jewish life, for which we would have to be prepared. He sensed the advent of an era when there would be no yeshivot in Brisk, Vilna, and Minsk, when America would be turned into a place of Torah, and when Israel, the state of Israel, would become the core center of Torah. God handed over technical legal matters to the authority of the sages, to rule on what is clean and what is unclean, to decide between obligation and exemption, forbidden and permitted. But in historical questions, not those relating to the legal status of ovens, food, or determination of fixed monetary obligations, but those relating to the destiny of the eternal people, God himself decides as to whose interpretation shall become the law. You remember the famous story of Achnai? We had this last year, some of you recall, with Rabbi Eliezer against the entire Sanhedrin about the status of a certain oven, if it was kosher or not. He said it was, everyone else says it wasn't. He invoked certain miracles to prove he was right, ultimately saying, if I'm right, let God come out of heaven himself, let a voice come out of heaven and say that I'm right. A voice comes out and says that he's right. And the whole Sanhedrin of Yeshua leading them says, it doesn't matter, lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. Basically, it's none of your business, God. It's up to us to determine the law. It's not up to you. Okay? And God says, when they later found, if you remember, Rabbi ran into Rabbi Eliezer, into Elijah the prophet one day, and asked him, what did God do at that moment? And Elijah said, God laughed, and he said, my children have defeated me, my children have defeated me. Showing that God takes pride in, Jews, as it were, even defeating God at the intellectual level, and through the Talmud. But in any event, Rav Soloveitchik says, that was good by an oven. That's good by a halakhic question, but when it comes to major issues of the survival of the Jewish people, God decides that himself, like the case of Joseph, like this case here. Nor can anyone dispute the ruling of God in this domain. In the controversy between Joseph of yore and his brothers thousands of years ago, God decided in accord with Joseph's interpretation of the historical process. In our days, the creator of the universe similarly decided that the historical law will be as the Joseph of 5662 religious Zionists had predicted. In accord with the view of him who had little faith in the future of East European Jewry and who dreamed of another land and other conditions. My affiliation with Mizrahi. Again, as I stress, the altar of get you out of from your birthplace still exists. Many Talmudic scholars still suffer. I prefer to speak about myself rather than others. This is in the early 1950s, he was writing this. I was not born into a Zionist household. My parents, ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from Mizrahi religious Zionists. They too held wine metal in the secrets of the Merciful One. My links with the Mizrahi grew gradually. I had my doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. In the final analysis, my roots reached very deeply into the oral tradition, into Talmudic learning. My entire world outlook was crystallized in the atmosphere of Rambam and Ravid, of legal conceptualization. Nevertheless, the land of Israel played a major role in my household. It's not that people are anti-Zionism or anti-Israel. You have to understand that. As someone once, like people said sometimes, Zionists were people who, it became a belief where you didn't have to live in Israel, and said, because you support a state of Israel. So who believes more in Zionism? Someone in America says, I give thousands to Israel, you know, to the state of Israel. Or let's say people in Orthodox communities who are picking up like mad and going to live in Israel. They'll say, we're living in Israel. You think it's such a big shot, sending your money and living in nice old America. We pick up and live in Israel. So Soloveitchik is just indicating that it's not like those who are anti-Zionist or anti-Israel. Not at all. Not at all. But they believed in a different Israel. He says, my father, Chaim, in the next prayer, Chaim of Bris, grandfather of Soloveitchik, was the first to logically analyze, define, and formulate at a high intellectual level concepts pertaining to Israel. The sanctity of the land. These are all halakhic concepts. The sanctity of the bounds, temporary sanctification, sanctification for eternity, entry of all of you into Israel, all its inhabitants, the non-Jewish acquisitionary rights, and so forth. These terms represented not only concepts, abstract thought, and formal novel ideas, but deep-rooted emotions, love, yearnings, and vision. The land of Israel, the sanctity of walled cities, the sanctity of Jerusalem, were my lullabies, my bedtime stories. He would sit and study the Rambam before bed. Rav Chaim was perhaps the greatest lover of Zion in his generation. He always played with the idea that once he had married off his children, he would hand over his rabbinate to one of his sons, settle in the land of Israel, buy an orchard, and fulfill the commandments pertaining to the land of Israel. The love of the land and the people of Israel could never be more fervently expressed than by Rav Chaim at the prayer on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, when he would pour out his heart in the sequence of Luvachain and thus prayers, as with melancholy, trembling, and saintly, he implored God for the realization of, and thus, God, render honor to thy people, praise to those with awesome awareness of you, and good hope to those who seek you, and access with your words to those who yearn for you, joy to your land, and happiness to your city. One who did not see Rav Chaim Soloveitchik and Yom Kippur, after the order of the service prayer, when he would intone all this while the temple was extant, the high priest performing the service, his generation seeing and rejoicing, happy is the eye that saw this. Whoever didn't see Rav Chaim never heard prayer so warm and overflowing with yearning in his life. His entire personality was transported to Jerusalem and interwoven with the priests and the people standing in the temple court. However, his love of Zion and Jerusalem has no relation to the Zionism of Chaim Weizmann, as expressed in the book Trial and Error. I haven't read it. They are in direct contradiction. If you think it is easy for me to get used to the partly heretical, partly enlightened, and partly Russian revolutionary testament of Chaim Weizmann in the last chapter of his book, where he develops his ideas of the spiritual image of the state of Israel so that God forbid it does not turn into a theocracy, you are wrong. An endless distance separates the outlook of Rav Chaim Weizmann and secular leaders from my outlook. I cannot understand their viewpoint. How can one in any way dream about rebuilding the land of Israel without the Lord of Israel? If I now identify with the Mizrahi against my family tradition, it is only because, as previously clarified, I feel that divine providence ruled like Joseph against his brothers, and that he employs secular Jews as instruments to bring to fruition his great plans regarding the land of Israel. That was his answer as to why non-religious Zionists could go ahead and bring out the state of Israel, because you don't have to be a religious Jew for God to use you. Rav Kook put it this way. Rav Kook said, you know what? He said, when they built the temple, where the high priest could only go into the Holy of Holies once a year, right, on Yom Kippur, and say God's special ineffable name one time on Yom Kippur. The only person who'd go into the Holy of Holies. But he said, you know what? When the carpenters were building the temple in the Holy of Holies, you think when they got a carpenter, they asked him, okay, how many days to study during the week? You know, you keep Shabbos. No, are you a good carpenter or a bad carpenter? That's all. So when they built the Holy of Holies, anyone who was good could build it. Anyone who knew what they were doing. Okay? So Soloveitchik said, so too, building the land, Rav Kook said, building the land that anyone could do, even people who weren't totally dedicated to Torah. But, of course, now it's up to us, he felt, to go ahead and spiritually, Rabbi Kook said, go ahead and make this, you know, a living land of the living blood of the Torah. But that was Rav Soloveitchik going with that as well. And finally, look at the last five lines here, six lines on the bottom of the page. The Mizrahi must also understand that we do not use the phrase Zionism plus religion or religious Zionism. I think before when it used it, the editor must have put in parentheses. As he said, we don't use the term religious Zionism. For us, there is only one unique noun, Torah. Israel is holy and dear because the Torah sanctified it and because the Torah's future is tied to it. Now, this may sound strange to people, but I know, like, in my class in Yeshiva University once, it's Rabbi Parnas, who I've quoted to you before, my mentor, once said that he got a letter from someone who wanted to live in Israel. And they said, I want to live in Israel because I believe the Torah says to do so and because I'm a Zionist. Rav Parnas said, what's the second one have to do with it? If the Torah says it, that's enough for a believing Jew. What does that have to do if you're a Zionist or not? If the Torah says to do so, it stops right there. Anyway, you could argue that, but that was his viewpoint. Rav Soloveitchik, who is the head of the religious Zionists of America, Mizrahi, that's how it's translated, says, don't call me a religious Zionist. No, don't say religious Zionism. There's only Torah. If Torah says you have to live there, you have to live there. There's nothing with religious and Zionism and some, you know, strange hybrid. Okay? I want to add something. If you ask me, how do I, as a Talmudic Jew, look upon the flag of the State of Israel? Has it any halachic value? Now, if you would ask, you would think you asked Moshe Feinstein, does the state, the flag of Israel have any halachic value? Does the United States flag have any halachic value? It's a nice flag. You say up to the pledge, you say Star Spangled Banner, saying I take halachic value, even if you're a religious Jew. It's a secular flag for the State of Israel. What halachic value could it have? And in fact, Moshe Feinstein was once asked about people who have flags in their synagogues. Some of you probably have flags in your temples and synagogues. Moshe Feinstein said, it's nonsense. Get them out. There's no meaning whatsoever. You know, that's a nationalistic thing. It's nothing to do with being shul. All right, fine. That's what he said. Okay. But Soloveitchik says, I would answer plainly. I do not hold at all with the magical attraction of flag or similar symbolic ceremonies. Judaism negates ritual connected with physical things. Nonetheless, we must not lose sight of a law in the Shulchan Aruch to the fact that one who has been killed by non-Jews is buried in his clothes. You don't do a tara on such a person. You don't prepare such a person with the Hever Kedisha. If a person is killed by a non-Jew, you bury him in his bloody clothes so that God will look and avenge his death. So he says, so his blood may be seen and avenged. As it is written, I will hold the heathen innocent, but not in regard to the blood which they have shed. In other words, the clothes of the Jew acquire a certain sanctity. In other words, you can't just take them off and throw them away. It has to stay just like it is. You know, there's something special about it. When spattered with the blood of a martyr. How much more is this so with a blue and white flag, which has been immersed in the blood of thousands of young Jews who fell in the War of Independence defending the country and the population, religious and irreligious alike. The enemy did not differentiate between them. It has a spark of sanctity that flows from devotion and self-sacrifice. We are all enjoined to honor the flag and treat it with respect. It does not require a hechsher, supervision from the non-Jewish union judge. This is just amazing. When I reference that he holds the flag of Israel, it's something, you know, you got to recognize people died for that flag. I mean, if you're not, you know, from the so-called classical religious approach, of course we all know the flag, Israeli flag. But from a religious perspective, this is something incredible, you know. The flag, he says, has some halachic value to it, as it were, and he quotes a law in Shulchan Aruch to prove it. Interesting. Anyway, this was his view of the State of Israel. He was very positive toward it, again, leading a generation of certainly American Jews to become, whether he likes it or not, was known as religious Zionists. I'm myself kind of in between, and I bet he was too. That's why I didn't use the term. They have a new term in Israel. Someone just told me that's called, they call it Chardal. Chardal, which means Badarevi Le'umi, which means like kind of, they call it like kind of right-wing yeshiva university. Kind of like I'm in the yeshiva world, but I also believe in the founding of the state. So on the one hand, I'm not one who believes in the redemption element, like, the redemption's here, and it's messianic times of the state, as some people believe. On the other hand, I'm not, like, against the state. I think something happened when Israel was founded. And Rav Soloveitchik, I think, was really in that camp. It's interesting that Rav Soloveitchik, despite his great feeling that the State of Israel was a miracle and showed God's hand active in Jewish history, nonetheless did not allow any prayers to be changed as a result. Against, you know, you probably all say, wherever we are, a temple or synagogue is a prayer for the State of Israel, what we say, right? you know, our Father in heaven or whatever it is, bless those who are, you know. Rosolvesic was against this prayer. He said, the Psalms of King David are good enough for us. He said, again, he was against it. The reason being is because he held prayer for serious business. He said, what, some a few rabbis of modern times just get together and just write up a prayer? Are you kidding? That's why he was against all sorts of liberal prayers and things being put into the service, new prayers. He held the prayers were written by prophets and then by Talmudic sages and the leaders of the generation. A guy can just write a prayer. Even on Tisha B'Av, which in the Art Scroll Tisha B'Av book, there is a special, two special prayers written, one by Rabbi Schwab, who was a great rabbi, head of the Breuer's community, and another one by the Bab Over Rebbe, a great, great Hasidic rabbi, about the Holocaust. They're beautiful, meaningful prayers. And I used to say them, you know, every year. Then I read, or Soloveitchik, I read something he wrote. He was against it. He said, I don't care who you are. You cannot write a prayer unless, he says, you're one of the Balei HaMesorah. In other words, unless you kind of go back to Talmudic times, right, you cannot go ahead and just write a prayer like that. So he objected, so I don't say it anymore. I say, if people want to say it, say it. Yeah, now he says, now the Middle Ages, those people, were the Rishonim, we call them, the first authorities, were the primary expositors of the Talmud. And that he considers them part of the absolute train of tradition to relate to us, to help us understand what the Talmud says. So he allows for that. But he says, modern times, for people to say, you know, we need a prayer, let's do it. Even those rabbis who wrote it, by the way, don't think it's like a guy who just says, oh, great, I'd love to write it. Sure. Oh, what an honor. These guys didn't want to write it. In fact, the Bab Over Rebbe, I think it was, quotes a beautiful statement by some rabbi who's obviously said, whoever has the ability to go ahead and to write about these terrible tragedies so people don't forget should go ahead and write about them. And even if they just be a small person and not a great rabbi, they should still write about them. So Rabbi Halberstam, I think it was, the Bab Over Rebbe says, so you see what this person said. So even a small person should write about them. So that's why I'm writing about them. I'm a small person, but he said to write about them, so I'm writing about them. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was against it. What can I tell you? He did not believe in introducing new prayers. I saw he allowed it only one time only. The year the state was founded and they made this prayer, he thought it would be great solidarity for all synagogues and temples like in the United States to say this prayer together. So he said everyone should say it, you know, for a while, as we have here, but in general he was against it. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was, again, very conservative. Don't think, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, the big liberal. People always say, they would have a quote like this, they say that we always talk about his leniencies, but not about his strict views. I mean, we haven't really looked at Rabbi Soloveitchik totally in the halachic realm. He has many, many strict views. For example, the Eruv, right, around since there, you can carry on Shabbos, remember that term, right? So Soloveitchik holds, like, a view of Maimonides that you shouldn't carry in the types of Eruvs that we have today. Most people don't hold it. He has a bunch of very, very strict things. He wasn't just what we call a cow, like a guy who just went around and said, you know, oh, this should change and this should change. I mean, it's not like that. And again, he didn't change anything per se. Even with the women's thing, he claimed Maimonides meant this, you know, that women weren't educated at the time when he said that women's mind could not learn Torah properly. He said because they weren't educated. He thought it didn't mean this because they were naturally not endowed. So whatever he saw there, you know, he claimed was already in the text. Don't take chances. You pray what's been accepted. Moses prayed this prayer. So I told him, so I know this works. David prayed these prayers. So I know they work. You make up a prayer. It could sound very beautiful. Who says it's going to be accepted? So he said, the notion is, he said, you have to have a matir. Something has to permit you to approach God. It's only permitted to approach God. You know these guys use these prayers and they got in. Who says you're going to write this prayer and you're going to get in with it? Not a personal prayer, but he means to make a formalized prayer and put it into the book. And everyone reads right. This like it's an obligation.